He was born as the second son to a father who would always favor his elder brother. It must have been hard seeing his dad take more of an interest in his brother than in him. Even though, admittedly, they had more in common, it was still hard to shake the feeling. Why not me? And of course, it didn't help their culture practice primogeniture, so not only dad, but everyone else would have reinforced the older son should have priority. Maybe Jacob started to wonder, what's wrong with me? Why don't I like the things dad likes? Why wasn't I born first? Esau and I are twins, after all, so it's not really like he's older than me. Maybe that's why Jacob always seemed dissatisfied with what he had. Maybe that's why he felt he was given a raw deal from the world, and it was up to him to make his own way through whatever means necessary. Whatever means necessary turned into taking advantage of his brother Esau when Esau was in a very vulnerable position, and then outright lying to their father in order to gain the rights, the estate, the inheritance of the firstborn. But even with all these maneuvers, he still didn't have what he wanted. Esau was so enraged at being cheated out of his rights that he plotted to kill Jacob, which forced Jacob to run away. What Jacob had fought for so long and thought he had obtained through his lies and deception, he hadn't really obtained it. He had to flee. And when he ran to his uncle. But his uncle, who was apparently cut from the same cloth as Jacob, was able to deceive the deceiver. Now Jacob is the one who has been tricked. Instead of swindling others, now Jacob has been swindled. Perhaps that intensified his angst that the world is not giving him what he believes he deserves. So what will he do after being played by his uncle? After he was tricked, after he was swindled, what will Jacob do? He will do what he has always done. He will deceive. He will conspire. He will manipulate whatever he can to get what he wants. He works a deal with his uncle where he will be allowed to keep certain kinds of animals in exchange for shepherding his uncle's flocks. And then he manipulates those flocks so his own herds increase while his uncle's decrease. Jacob has again cheated the system. But again, it starts to backfire on him. His cousins are jealous that their father's wealth has diminished. His uncle is skeptical. So Jacob runs. Again. And then he receives word that all of his scheming and deceptions might have finally caught up to him. Esau, his brother, is coming straight toward him. And he's not alone. Esau is bringing a small army of 400 men with him. Jacob believes his life might be over. Maybe this is the end of the road. Maybe this is as far as a con man can get. Maybe what he has always believed he needed and deserved, what he has schemed and manipulated for, maybe it was finally going to slip through his fingers for good and his life along with it. But he's not done yet. He still has an opportunity to outfox his brother one more time. So he does a few things. He divides his people up into different groups, thinking if Esau attacks one group, maybe the other group will be okay. Maybe I won't lose everything. Maybe I'll only lose part of it. He sends convoys of gifts out ahead of him to intercept his brother. Jacob says, perhaps all these gifts might pacify my brother. Perhaps he won't destroy me and everything I own with his 400-man army. Perhaps I can pay him off enough that he will forgive me for what I did to him so long ago. And he prays. He says something like, God, don't forget about me. You appeared to me once before, and when you did, God, you promised to make me great. But now my brother is coming. My brother is probably coming to kill me. It's going to be hard for you to make me great if I'm dead. So don't forget about me, God. And then Jacob sat down to spend the night alone before facing his brother. Little did he know, sitting alone that night, probably continuing to pray, probably continuing to scheme, continuing to worry. Little did he know that someone would respond to those prayers and would come to meet him face to face before his brother would ever get the chance. This is where we pick up the story this morning in our scripture reading. It's Genesis 32, verses 22 through 32. That'll be up on the screen. It's in your bulletin insert as well, but Genesis 32, starting in verse 22. That night, Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons and crossed the ford of Jabbok. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. This is such a bizarre account, such a strange meeting with someone, that on the surface, we may not know what to make of it. But what we will discover is that this story is often our story for many of us, if not most of us. And if it hasn't been your story, you might find out today that you want it to become your story. So we'll look at three aspects of this account this morning. One, why do we persist? Two, why do we wrestle? I mean, who do we wrestle? Why do we persist? Who do we wrestle? And three, who wins? So one, why do we persist? Jacob starts persisting before our specific text. Remember, Jacob learns his brother is coming for him, so he splits up his employees and his possessions. He sends gifts ahead to pacify his brother, and he prays. He's persisting. He deploys one tactic, and apparently he decides that's not enough, so he prays. But maybe that's not enough either, so he sends gifts. And then he spends the night alone. I don't believe it's any stretch of the imagination to say that Jacob probably kept praying and scheming throughout the night. Wouldn't you? He's thinking, "I conned my brother years ago. Now he has gathered an army and he's coming for me." You think if you were all by yourself the night before an army was coming for you, that you'd just drift off to sleep like that? No, of course not. Right? We're all the same. You're going to be praying all night, even if you've never prayed before. That might be the day that you start. You'd be like, "Hey, God, I don't know if you're up there, but if you are, hi. I need some help, man. Come on down. Any minute now," right? Then you'd probably draw a map in the sand to see if you had actually schemed the best way to face your brother. And then you'd probably pray some more. What is that? We're going back and forth between freaking out, praying, planning, freaking out, praying, planning, freaking out, praying, planning, freaking out, praying, planning. What is that? That's wrestling. That's what it feels like. It feels like a wrestling match. We can't get the upper hand. There is a situation that we are trying to conquer, to subdue, to control, but it keeps just squirming out from underneath of us, eluding us. When there is a giant, urgent problem that has potentially life-ending implications for us or those we love, we wrestle with it. Now, Jacob physically wrestles as well. We'll see that in a minute. But I believe that external wrestling mirrors the internal struggle that's going on with Jacob. This could be a literary device showing the internal struggle by describing the external struggle, even though the external struggle is also simultaneously happening. Jacob is battling on two fronts. One is with this attacker, but there is another battle raging in his mind, and it is just as strenuous. He wants something. Have you been there? In this case, he wants security or assurance that he will be okay, and he doesn't have it. He does not have it right now. The future is up in the air, so he's wrestling with it. And he's going to keep wrestling with it. He is going to keep persisting until he gets an answer. Verse 24, they wrestled all night until the breaking of day. Verse 26, he says, I will not let you go. He is persisting. He persists for the same reason we do, because we don't have what we think we need. That's why we persist. Of course, that's why we persist. That's why all of us persist. This is such an obvious point that you might wonder why we should even take time to mention why we persist, because we all do it. But it'll become important later, okay? This is just a building block. We'll get there. The building block is we pray and hope and struggle for what we think we need, but we don't have. That's why we persist. Jacob wanted to somehow emerge unscathed from this confrontation with his brother. For most of us, our struggles are probably different, aren't they? Not too many of us very often have a 400-man army coming for us. But when we're in the middle of our struggles, they seem just as dire, don't they? They seem just as serious, just as all-consuming of our thoughts and our energy, like we might die if we don't get it worked out. In fact, we might prefer a 400-man army to be coming for us, compared to what it feels like that we're dealing with sometimes. We want to be in a relationship. We want to get married. We might want someone specific. We're like, I need him. I need her. I want him or her so much it hurts. We want children. We want a happy marriage. We want our spouse to treat us better. We want to move along in our career. We want any job at all. We want our kids to be successful, to find someone, to find their place in the world. We want a house. We're tired of the 35 square feet we have to go home because we live in the Bay. We want the market or our investments to bend in our favor. If we just get a little bit more, then we could be there. We want to be reconciled to that person we lost. It breaks us up inside that we're separated from that person. We want health. We're tired of always battling some new ailment or the one that won't go away. We wish we didn't hurt like we do physically. And if we can't have health, then give me the grave, right? I just don't want to be in pain anymore. What is it that you're persisting for? What is it that you are wrestling right now? You can't get the upper hand. You can't get control. Whatever it is for you, I know two things about it. It's something you don't currently have, and it's something you think you need. You feel you must have it, but it is uncertain if you will get it or not. And that is why you persist. That's common sense, of course. It's just so obvious. Because if all of a sudden you had the thing, you would stop persisting for it, right? Likewise, if you suddenly realized you didn't need it, if you didn't really need it, then you'd stop persisting for it. It's obvious. The reason we always persist is because we think we need something and we don't have it. We'll come back to that. Second aspect of this account, who do we wrestle? Who do we wrestle? You're like, didn't we just cover that? Hello. I want the relationship, a good relationship. I want the career, the house, the health, the cure, the security, the recognition, the grade, the approval, the acceptance, to be noticed or remembered or thought of. I want all those things. I want all those things for my kids. I want all of them for my grandkids. Once I have myself all kind of set, I start planning and stressing on behalf of them. I want it all. That's what I want. All of it. And that's what I'm wrestling. That's what I'm persisting for. Isn't that what we just covered? Well, let's look at Jacob. Jacob started there, but he ended somewhere else. At the start of our text, and even before, he is wrestling with how to confront his brother. He divides up his possessions and family. He prays for deliverance. That's his initial persistence. Then someone attacks him in the middle of the night when he is alone. He could have easily assumed this was his brother attacking him, thinking, oh, Esau must have come early. He came to me when I was alone. That would have made sense. But the more they wrestle, the more obvious it becomes that this mystery attacker is not his brother. And it seems to land on Jacob just exactly who he is wrestling in verses 25 and 26. After they had been wrestling all night, this man touched Jacob's hip, and it was immediately and severely wounded. With just a touch, Jacob now walks with a limp. And this word for touch is not a word that means some kind of jujitsu, world wrestling, kung fu, power-up, super punch. In the Old Testament, it often means even the lightest contact possible. It's the word used in all the cleanliness laws, like don't touch a dead animal, don't touch a dead body, and if you do, then you're going to need to go wash your hands really well. These laws were saying even if you only have a small amount of contact, you still need to go wash. You could imagine a child saying, trying to make excuses, getting out of washing his hands, something like, I only brushed up against that antelope carcass. That's all I did. You know, I didn't squeeze it with all my might in between my fingers so goo got everywhere, or like rub it against my face or break it into pieces, so I don't need to go wash. And the parent would say, yeah, you do, right? Even a little bit of contact means you need to go now disinfect, right? Because we don't know how that animal died. We don't know what happened to it. You need to go wash, kid. You can think of this word like how you might check to see if a stove is hot. You done that? Like barely not touching, not touching, not touching, not touching, not touching, not touching. Contact with the smallest amount of surface area possible. Okay, it's not hot. All right, we're good. And just that slightest contact, that brushing up against Jacob's hip, gave him a serious injury. Jacob realizes instantly who this is that he's wrestling. There's only one person who could barely make contact and yet have such an effect. It's God. He's wrestling God. He says so down in verse 30. Jacob says, I have seen God face to face. The wrestler identifies himself as God in verse 28. He tells Jacob, you have wrestled with God. The wrestler changed Jacob's name to Israel, further evidence that this mysterious figure is in fact God, because it is God who gives people new names. The narrative began by calling the wrestler a man, maybe because that was Jacob's understanding at the start, or maybe this is a pre-incarnate Christ. So this is a man and also God who is wrestling Jacob. But as the narrative progresses, Jacob's understanding progresses. And eventually, by the end of the story, we, like Jacob, know who this is. It seems to dawn on Jacob in verse 25 when his hip is wrenched, because in verse 26, he very strangely begins asking for something from his opponent. Jacob asks for something that doesn't make any sense unless he knows that he's wrestling God. He asked his attacker in the middle of fighting him to bless him. Now, I've never been mugged. Thank the Lord. Nobody try it in the parking lot. I've never fought off an attacker other than like childhood fights. Someone has never jumped me in the middle of the night. But if someone did, I think I would only have three possible goals. I think. One, fight back hard enough so I disabled the attacker. Two, fight back hard enough so the attacker would run away. Or three, I'd run away myself. Like fight or flight. If I'm in the middle of a fight, I really can't think of much else that I'd be trying to do. And I don't think any of us would be holding on to our attacker, not letting him go, and ask for his blessing. Like while I'm hanging on, like I have my arm around his neck, right, and I say something like, Let your favor shine upon me. I'll take a couple swings at you. Like, pull your collar down and say, I need to experience your goodness. I'm not going to let go until I hear that you love me. That's not what we would beg an attacker to give us. It doesn't make any sense. But Jacob does it. And it shows us, at that moment, Jacob figured out who he had been wrestling. And simultaneously, he figured out what he really needed. Up until that moment in his life, Jacob thought he needed to wrestle everyone else. He thought he needed his father's blessing. He thought he needed his brother's inheritance. He thought he needed his uncle's flocks and herds. He thought he needed to marry the one. Jacob's entire life had been marked by a restlessness, a dissatisfaction with where he was, what he had, who he was with. He looked to fill that void with recognition, praise, approval, money, relationship, status. But the restlessness remained. It didn't solve what was missing for him. He was still worried and anxious and scheming. So he persisted. But then on this night, he changes his focus. And he says, really, the one that I need is God. Really, the one I need is the one who is attacking me. And I'm not going to let go until I have him. Until I know his love for me. Until I can experience his goodness, until he blesses me, I'm not letting go. Remember, we said we persist because we don't have what we think that we need. And we're going to keep persisting until either we get it or we realize, hey, I don't really need it. And we're like, yeah, that's obvious. Like, why even make that point? Here's why we make that point. Because in the middle of this fight, Jacob stops persisting for security from his brother. And he starts persisting for something else. The situation with his brother is still up in the air. Who knows what's going to happen? He might get executed tomorrow. But he's not praying about that anymore. He's not scheming how to face his brother anymore. He realizes security from his brother is not what he actually needs. And it's never what he really needed. He needed something else. He needed someone else. And if he had had that someone else, maybe from the beginning of his life, maybe he wouldn't have needed the approval from his father. Maybe he wouldn't have needed his brother's inheritance, his uncle's wealth, or the love that made his knees buckle. He wakes up. He says, I've been persisting for the wrong thing my entire life. Is it possible that in your current struggle right now, you are trying to settle a restlessness that can only be quieted by God? Is it possible you are trying to fill a void in your heart that only God can fill? Whatever it is that's consuming your thoughts and prayer life, that you are sure you have to have, or you just might die. Like, you're going to explode if you can't get it. Is it possible you are trying to meet one of your needs with something that really only God alone can meet? By feeling his presence, experiencing his goodness, by knowing his grace. Is that possible? When Jacob realized that, it changed everything for him. He no longer prayed about his brother. He didn't persist for deliverance from his brother. Instead, he persisted to know God. He said, God, let me know you. Tell me your name, he says in verse 29. It's like, I found the one who has been missing from my life, and now all I want is more of him. Maybe your current struggle will continue. I want to say this ever so lightly because this might not apply to your situation or case at all. You might need to forget that I just said this, okay? You might need to forget it. It might not be for you at all. But maybe your current struggle will continue. Maybe not. Maybe not. But maybe your current struggle will continue until somehow it clicks with you that God is the one that you really need. Maybe. You're like, does that mean I'm not going to get what I'm dying to have? I have no idea. I'm not a prophet, and everyone is different, okay? That's up to God. He's going to give you what's best for you always. If it's best for you to have it, you'll get it. So absolutely keep praying for it. Absolutely keep fighting for it. Absolutely persist. Just don't be surprised. This could happen. Don't be surprised if after wrestling all night, you realize you never really needed it in the first place. And you needed God far more. Even if it's something as large as a 400-person army is coming straight for you. You're like, oh, I don't need deliverance from that. What I need is God. Don't be surprised if that happens. Okay, final aspect of this story. Who won? Isn't this odd? Like, we had a wrestling match. There has to be a victor. This is really the strange thing. God is wrestling with Jacob, and yet it says God could not overpower Jacob, verse 25. So there's something God can't do. Do we really believe that? Is that what we're saying? That's kind of weird. Yet at the same time, we saw even the slightest touch from God blew out Jacob's hip. So it seems like God could have won decisively at any moment. And if he actually, like, put his weight into it, like, for real hit Jacob, oh my goodness, right? It's no more Jacob. That's what would have happened. On Jacob's side, in verse 26, the attacker says, let me go. And Jacob replies, I'm not letting you go, which that implies Jacob has the upper hand over his attacker. But then down in verse 30, Jacob is astonished that he has lived. He feels as if his life has been spared by the attacker, like he should have died as a result of this battle, but the attacker was merciful and let him live. So that makes it seem like the attacker had the upper hand. So what in the world is going on? Who wins? Both win, and both lose. Both win, and both lose. Jacob first. Jacob lost. His hip was out of joint. He was defeated by even the lightest touch. But in the same moment, he gained something far better. Instead of seeking a certain set of circumstances, he began to seek God. He overpowered his attacker and got the blessing he asked for. He knew that God loved him now. He experienced God's presence. He no longer needed his father's blessing, the financial security, the relationship. He now possessed a treasure that was immeasurably greater than all of those things. So he won. But in the midst of that, he lost. He was changed forever. He had a new identity. In a sense, Jacob did die that day. When he saw God face to face, who he was before that moment was lost forever. There was no more Jacob. There was no more schemer, liar, trickster, deceiver. There was only Israel, the one who was born through struggle and found God. Maybe that's when some of us have found God, in the midst of a struggle. And we look back on that struggle now and we're like, thank you for that, God. Now for God, God lost. He was overpowered. He couldn't pull away from the one he attacked. Yet at the same time, God won. By being overpowered, he won Jacob. God makes himself weak in order to connect with us and win our hearts. God intentionally loses in order to gain us. He could have incinerated Jacob into dust, just like that, without any infinity stones. And he could have won the battle. Just like that. But if he had done that, he would have lost Jacob. Instead, he chooses to lower himself, to weaken himself, to engage with Jacob long enough for Jacob to be changed, to win Jacob. He says, Jacob, I'm going to let you pound on me for a while so we can be together, so you can find me. Until you realize you've been trying to fill your needs with everything except me your entire life. It's such a picture of grace. Because who would want Jacob? Who would go to these lengths to get Jacob. Nearly all of Jacob's relationships have eventually come to ruin. His scheming, lying, deceiving has isolated him from many of the significant people in his life. When you read the narrative of Jacob, there isn't a whole lot to like about the guy. And yet God says, I'll take you. In fact, God says, I'll take a beating to be with you. When Jacob harmed others, Jacob needed to run for fear of retribution. But when Jacob took swings at God, God blessed him. This sets up the principle, of course, that ultimately culminates in the crucifixion of Christ, when God lowered himself, taking the very nature of a servant, becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Not until God became completely weak could we be completely with him. On the cross, Jesus lost to sin. He let himself be overpowered by evil, becoming sin for us, taking all of our sin upon himself so that we could be free from it forever. And then, with just the slightest touch, Jesus gave a fatal blow to death, putting death itself in the grave. He resurrected back to life, and therefore, he has overcome sin and darkness forever, uniting us to himself so that we can be completely with him, so that our sin is no longer in the way of us being able to be with him, so we can stand with him face to face forever. Maybe in the midst of your struggle right now, you'll find something better that you didn't even know you were looking for. Maybe the war you are in the middle of has been given to you as a gift to point your focus to someone else. Maybe you can't see who your attacker is right now, but he loves you. He's so beautiful. His goodness outshines every hurt and insecurity, and his presence dries every tear. Do not let go until you have him, until you can see him like Jacob saw him and realized, really, truly, this is the only one that I need. Let's pray together.